I'm Leonard Nimoy. The following tale of alien encounters is true, and by true, I mean false. It's all lies, but they're entertaining lies, and in the end, isn't that the real truth? The answer is no.
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Think of your fellow man, lend him a helping hand, put a little love in your heart. You see it's getting late, oh, please don't hesitate, put a little love in your heart. And the world will be a better place, and the world will be a better place for you. Me, you just wait and see. Another day goes by, and still the children cry. Put a little love in your heart. If you want the world to know, we won't let hatred grow. Put a little love in your heart, and the world will be. Wait and see.
Hey everybody, this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. We were just listening to dearly departed Leonard Nimoy and hearing that key change. That guy had vocal range, don't kid yourself.
Who are you?
I'm Dean Haglund, and you are my co-host and everyone else's co-host who listens to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. You're Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
Without me actually sliding some dials on the mixing board, you're at a loss, aren't you? Where are we coming from?
Why? And where we always come from, the offices of Rational Exuberance, here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia.
I'm going to turn your level up a
turn
little bit.
Turn me up a bit.
Suddenly, yeah, you're...
This microphone, I'm on the old 1972 Dink Winkerson model that made him famous for bowling for dollars, as
you do you
remember.
Hear that? Greg Vincent at the UCLA Office of Instructional Development. We need you. And seriously, GV, thank you for your help in this regard. We sent over two mics that have been down for the count, and we desperately need them, especially not just because your mic is
embarrassingly lean.
Actually, he knows of that mic, and he knows where I got that mic, and he remembers where when and from where I took that microphone.
Wow.
But also, someday we're going to need guests, and two mics are not going to cut it anymore. And really, fixing the microphones for us is what Leonard Nimoy would have wanted.
Yeah, it's true. I was just at
celebrity deaths.
Oh, right.
You were just at probably something that should be covered under live events of the week.
Probably.
But where was it?
Well,
what was
it? The Long Beach Comic Expo at the Long Beach Convention Center. And the lovely thing they did at the start, they made everyone have a minute of silence with the hand up over their head and a Vulcan gesture for a minute, and then followed by 30 seconds of loud applause for all the entertainment he's given us over the years.
If I did that, my hand up over my head like that,
yep.
I would have interrupted the silence by going, pain, pain.
Actually, I think I heard that on the other side of the auditorium.
And then you would have asked me, what was it? And then I would have said, waves and waves of pain. The See, Devil in the Dark,
exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen. Star Trek episode.
We're going to quote just all the episodes throughout the show.
Leonard Nimoy died on Friday. He'd been very, very ill of late. And this touched a lot of people.
Right.
I was born in 1968.
Yes, the year the show came in.
So Star Trek had been on the air since 1966.
Right.
The 2001 A Space Odyssey came out shortly before my birth.
I thought it was 69 then.
A Man Walked on the Moon in 69,
right.
About 9 months after my, 7 months, 8 months. I was told there'd be no math at that age.
Right.
After my birth. So really, science fiction, space exploration, Star Trek are all things that have been with me since I was born.
Right.
You know, being born into that, you know, it's interesting because that was part of the cultural conversation you heard adults having.
Yeah.
And my earliest memories are of, you know, climbing up into my dad's lap because I'm scared to death of the Gorn, right, on Star Trek.
That thing scared you?
The first short story I ever wrote when I was 3.5 years old.
Right.
And I still have the notebook, the Mead spiral notebook with a green cover. I've always loved the color green. And it was Star Trek and the Mystery of the Metal Men.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you hate Doctor Who. I don't understand. It sounds right. like a Doctor Who plot.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. No, well, I agree with you. At 3.5 years of age, I was good enough quality to write for Doctor Who.
Oh, bizarre.
You set that
I
up.
Did,
oh,
my God.
How does a celebration of Leonard Nimoy become the utter dissing of things people love? That's not where I intended. And listeners, look, everybody knows that I'm willing to diss Doctor Who, but I did not
go there. You just
Dean Haglund
pitched a volley over the net.
I mean, if I did not spike it, it very well might have landed on someone.
That's right. You did it for the safety of everyone.
It was violence prevention.
Thank you.
So, yeah. So this is, I mean, for so many people, right? A childhood icon.
Mm-hmm.
But really, everybody knows of Mr. Spock. You and I had the good experience of being on Topless Robot Live. I think it was the second episode of the podcast.
Yes.
From Topless Robot, the great entertainment site run by our friend Luke Y. Thompson.
Yes.
And he posted about, in the wake of Nimoy's death, that although he and his friends were bigger Star Wars fans
right.
when they were kids, the only popular figures that were truly iconic were Christopher Reeve as Superman and Leonard Nimoy as Spock. Truly iconic, meaning that when you were playing with action figures, when you were playing make-believe as a kid,
right.
you could be Han Solo, you could be Luke Skywalker, you could be Captain Kirk, but only Christopher Reeve could be Superman and only Leonard Nimoy. Could be Spock.
That's right.
You couldn't aspire to be those.
Exactly.
Because they were real.
Yeah, yeah.
In the minds of you know,
right.
our friends and us. That's what... And that's a pretty cool definition of iconic.
It sure is.
Really.
That it's a real character
that it lives
and breathes inside yeah. your mind.
So. You know, so much has been written about him, and yet very little... you know, many people have mentioned, of course, In Search Of.
Right.
You know, if you weren't a Star Trek fan, I mean, think about that, because we've encountered, if you're a conspiracy theorist, if you're someone interested in the paranormal, in alternative views of history, you probably dug In Search Of. It might have been a real inspiration at one point. So whether you were a Star Trek fan or not, you knew Leonard Nimoy.
Exactly. You knew that voice.
If you loved Mission Impossible, and that was quite a sizable fan base,
yep.
you loved Leonard Nimoy.
Absolutely.
The cameo that we played at the beginning, the little clip at the beginning, was when Nimoy played himself on an episode of The Simpsons.
Ah, right.
The X-Files episode.
Yes.
And he introduced it. And so there's another fan base that he touches into. And, of course, such great work on stage, really gifted photographer.
Mm-hmm.
If you liked comedy movies of the right. 80s,
Three Men and a Baby.
Yeah,
directed
Three Men and a Baby.
Think of that.
His approach to comedy. And of course, Star Trek for the Voyage Home, the one with the whales, was a comedy. And his
That's right.
his direction of comedy, you might not think going in would be so adept as it was.
Right.
Because after all, he was the logical one. He wasn't the funny one.
And yet, what a sense of humor he had.
But isn't it interesting, we had Steve Kaplan on the show.
Yes, we did.
And it's interesting, and this is true of you as well, people who are very gifted at it, you often find take a very logical approach to comedy.
Right. That is just like A must be B, so C, therefore... And and then hilarity ensues when you try to put those three together.
Right.
And it's the incongruousnessness.
So, but the thing that I personally find in the words of Mr. Spock fascinating
yes.
is to recall that before he was cast in Star Trek, I think he famously said that he'd never had a gig that had lasted more than 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, his movie roles, his television work, you know, just guest starring stuff, supporting
bad guys.
Stuff.
Yeah.
He'd probably done stage roles, but I think it was on camera in Hollywood. Since he'd come to Hollywood,
right.
He'd only had gigs that lasted 2 weeks or less. But what's interesting is, and I never really heard him talk about this too much in interviews, and maybe if someone has interviews about this, they could send me links, but he was kind of the go-to method instructor here in Hollywood up until getting cast in Star Trek.
I did not know.
He was a very acclaimed and sought-after teacher for those who wished to learn and practice the method.
Strasberg's method acting.
And when you think about Nimoy's performance, and it's easy to forget, I mean, because Star Trek... Oh, and by the way, not because of this, but just apropos of it having been decades now, I've started watching the original Star Trek series from the beginning.
Ah.
And I've been watching them with Lily, who'd only ever seen a handful of episodes. So we'd been watching from the beginning. And I was reminded again of the fact that Leonard Nimoy, who would be Emmy-nominated for his work on Star Trek.
Right.
This was not a show, believe it or not, that was a big hit with critics, that was an award recipient.
Right.
Was not a big hit with audiences, of course, as we know. But it was a big hit and meaningful to some really important opinion makers and some really important demographics. But he received Emmy nominations for his work, and when you think about the uphill climb that was,
right,
playing an alien
in a limited
in
emotional
a science
range.
Fiction
right.
show, neither of which was going to be taken seriously as a show for adults at all. You're an alien on science fiction
who apparently has no emotions, so you got to limit your emotional range and yet carry that show.
And so what you see when you go back to the very beginning is a man who brought the method to television. And I can't say for a fact that there were no actors before him that did this.
Right.
What I can say is, as far as I can tell, there have been no shows that have stood the test of time that survived.
Right.
With a following so that I would know about it.
Right.
So as far as I know, he's the first person to bring the method to television.
Huh. Fascinating.
And
as
the performances are...
It's still great, and it still holds up when you watch it now. That's the thing. Like, you know, some performances look dated in, say, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea or Twilight Zone. A lot of those acting styles seem false or unreal to us in this day and age. And yet you look at the original Star Trek, all of that holds true to form.
You know, he would write a book... a few years after Star Trek went off the air called I Am Not Spock.
I Am Not Spock, I think I have it.
And a story would go that one of the Paramount execs, when one of the Star Trek movies was coming up and negotiations were underway, and you know, one of the execs brought up, well, why should we even have you when you don't like Star Trek? And he said, what do you mean I don't like Star Trek? Well, you wrote a book about how much you don't like Star Trek. And he was referencing I Am Not Spock. And that was kind of the going tale publicly, was that book was about how he really wanted to distance himself from Star Trek, instead of looking at it for what it really was in retrospect, which was a method actor needing to do basically the 12 steps required to separate himself from this character that he had birthed.
Right.
And, you know, because the method connects the character so profoundly to your own emotional material.
Yeah.
That it really is...
An exploration of your own emotional core.
And it requires a process of letting go.
Right.
Many of the method actors went stark raven nuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they lost, if they ever had it, any sight of who they were at their core as human beings. And in fact, I'll go one step further, were at their most sane when they were playing characters.
Yes.
Because only then did they know who they were.
Ah, right.
And so he needed this separation in order to kind of regain his sanity, especially at a time when the show was over. It was no longer a job, and yet people seemed to be recognizing him and identifying with him as Spock more and more and more, because the popularity in the early 70s was really starting.
Right.
So imagine that. Everyone in exponentially is starting to recognize you as this
character you did in the
that
60s.
You have no longer have an outlet for.
Right. And have tried to let go.
And are trying to let go of. So hence, I am not Spock. More than a decade goes by, of course, maybe even two decades, and he finally writes, I am Spock. And it is a really touching book. And one of the things now that takes on greater meaning as I look back at it and with greater wisdom as a man in middle age, but also as someone who has immersed himself in the arts,
right,
and the performing arts for the decades since this book came out. But it was a two-person conversation, I am Spock. A dialogue going back between Leonard Nimoy and Spock,
uh-huh,
in looking at the events of Leonard Nimoy's life. So he gives full
voice.
Life and voice to this real being,
real being
that he has created. So a fascinating man. And as I posted on Facebook, there might very well be a time. I know we live in a culture that refuses to let go of anything,
right?
And and that is to our detriment. And it terrifies us that there might be a time when no one knows what Star Trek is
right.
anymore. But people might very well still know who Leonard Nimoy was, even if Star Trek gets forgotten. And if you were to give, really. Kurtzman and Orsi and J.J. Abrams a couple more cracks at Pat, I'm sure Star Trek would be forgotten.
Another zinger.
But at least for those of us who live in Los Angeles and who love science and
right.
love exploration.
What better
and,
way?
And that's, suddenly I've narrowed that field. Great deal.
There's a couple guys at JPL, I'm sure.
But Leonard Nimoy's name will never be forgotten if for no other reason than what he did
for
as benefactor for the Griffith Observatory.
Yeah.
Spearheading the renovation. There's an entire wing that bears his name.
Absolutely. He narrates a lot of the introductory videos in the thing. And he was a major... financier, where they dug up the whole front lawn and made that the basement, and the whole quadrupling the size of that whole facility, which is great because you think of how much you play an actor who's pretending to be in space, and then realizing how much his passion really was in astronomy and in actual space exploration.
Yeah,
good for him.
And an actor who really, not only in his roles but through his career and through his activism, really did embody this quest for. What is it that's the best of humanity?
Yeah, true. He'll be missed.
Quite a legacy.
Yes.
So you mentioned your excursion to Long Beach.
Yes.
And this is the drill. We're hearing the drill. Wow. It's as if they remain silent out of deference to Mr. Nimoy.
Yes. And just when we finish that segment, we, of course, live in a historical building.
Which people love to...
drill into.
Alter. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Let's change everything. So before we move on to our live events of the week and hear about your excursion to Long Beach, it should probably be pointed out that after the little Simpsons cameo, we heard evidence of Mr. Nimoy's attempt to embody the best of humanity, his cover of the classic Put a Little Love in Your Heart.
Fantastic. And what vocal range, huh?
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
So, tell me more of this excursion to Long Beach.
Well, for those who don't know, Long Beach has a Comic-Con twice a year. One's a Comic-Con, one's a Comic Expo. I have no idea what the difference is.
This one was Comic Expo.
This one was Comic Expo.
Not Comic-Con.
Right. And for those who are sick and tired of San Diego Comic-Con and how it sells out in 20 minutes, and you don't get to see any of the artists and support... actors and find out new projects. Long Beach is really the one to go to because it is a smaller convention. It has less attendees, but no less creative outfits, no less of the amount of talent hanging around. Camden Roy was there, Phil Lamar, Richard Hatch, myself, the woman who was Rena Owen from New Zealand was there. And so exciting, lots of fun, sold. What was the big hit at the con at my table? I'm talking Truth Is Out There DVDs. Could not keep them on the table.
Well,
I know. That's what I said.
Well, I actually did look at some of the photos to see if you brought any and if they were on the table and how they were selling.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's good to hear, you know. Yeah. And people don't have to only see you in person. That's the best way to get them. But that's not the only way to get them.
True.
People can obtain our epic documentary of comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy. The Truth Is Out There at truth-is-out-there.com. The Truth Is Out There with dashes. In between, there's many ways to get to see it. Blu-ray, DVD, streaming online, download, VOD, pay-per-view. So many ways.
So
and
many.
You can find out all about them at the newly redesigned Truth Is Out There website.
Hooray!
We'll be starting back up on shooting stuff for the sequel
shortly.
Beginning of April. Yeah, shortly.
Wow.
So that'll be a lot of fun.
It sure will.
I was back at St. Francis High School.
No, your favorite.
In La Cañada, Flint Ridge, to see their latest production.
Right. You're always blown away by their productions.
Increasingly so, in case you've noticed that. Now, St. Francis is a high school, but with a really an amazing performing arts program. And they call talent from many schools in the area, not just from St. Francis.
Right.
So they put on a production of Les Miserables.
Oh, you're kidding.
A three-hour Les Miserables. And I got out of the car yesterday, and it suddenly dawned on me what we were there to see.
Right. A three-hour tale of French Revolution.
Yeah, it's The Fugitive with songs.
Exactly. And a French Revolution backed up.
I don't know how many people these days realize that The Fugitive was based on Victor Hugo's
Les
Miserables.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, anyway. Oh. So
wrongly accused.
So I get out of the car, and it dawns on me, and I suddenly shout out in the parking lot at a Catholic school, Jesus H. Christ, I fucking hate Les Miserables. It just had to be said.
It had to be said.
Because I always have.
It's not a straight narrative.
That movie, boy, that was a dog.
They were faithful to the stage production.
I guess they were, though the way that it was shot did not do any benefits to them.
They were trying to make it more than it...
So anyway, bottom line is, first time ever, loved it.
What?
Loved it. Loved this production. There is something about really, really talented young people doing this that adds a level of emotional immediacy to this, especially in the young characters, the Eponine, the Morius, is it
right,
Morius,
I
the
guess.
Young man?
Yeah. What about the small waif of a girl who...
Yeah, I mean, so you have little kids playing that part, but of course you always would anyway, but it's just... Marius was the name of the character, and it played by my young friend Aaron Baker. So I've become really spoiled because these shows that they're doing get better and better, and in no small... way they get better and better because often the leads are played by Taylor Hancock, who's graduating. And I've talked about him before when he played Daniel Caffey in A Few Good Men. And I talked about how
amazing
his comedic timing is and his ability to listen. His ability, as I always like to point out, to do an impersonation of someone listening, because that's really what acting requires.
Right.
Often.
Yeah, impersonating someone listening.
Yeah, sometimes it's really listening.
Right.
But even when you're in great artifice where that becomes
tough,
difficult, it becomes doing an impersonation of someone listening, believably. Right. And as I've always said, that's why Tommy Lee Jones became a star, because he gives a really good impression of someone listening and thinking.
Right. Even though he probably couldn't give a rat's ass what
Maybe.
You're saying.
Yeah. Although it helps, right? Because he's one of those guys that only reads the script once.
Yeah.
So he might really be listening because he just doesn't know.
Doesn't know your lines. And so he's waiting to hear maybe what's a cue or something.
But Aaron is a junior, and so I look forward to seeing, and I've said before, well, look, there's actually two performers In the play, Aaron and the young lady who played Eponine, Gabrielle Current, I've already, for one of them, I've already done it, and the other I'm in the process of writing parts for both of them.
Wow.
In a film I'm going to be making at
Look
some
at
point.
That. You're so impressed by them.
Yeah.
Wow.
I already know exactly what I want them to do and what their roles will be. I don't even know if either of them plan on pursuing performing
right.
as they venture off into their college careers. I would hope so.
Quite the stunners.
I plan on working with both of them.
And look at that program that you pulled out, by the way. That's a glossy cover, fully photographed. There must be some funding to that little... St. Francis School for these theater programs.
Are you thinking about transferring?
I'm going to get my GED.
From New South Wales Community College.
That's right.
Where you were going to enroll in this June. And
now
New South Wales, which is nowhere near Sydney, right?
No, it is. It's the province of... That's the province
wow,
Sydney
Wow, I got
is
that
in.
Right. That's
Look
amazing.
You. Yeah, you're very impressive.
Why, thank you. Yeah. All right, what's going on tonight at... The Big and Tall.
Oh, it's Big and Tall Show. Another excellent show with me and Steve Benequist co-hosting again. And a delightful appearance, as always, Henry Phillips, whom you may know from numerous hilarious shorts. One that I still
You don't have
at.
To go too heavy on
Henry Phillips
the bookings, because by the time anyone hears this, that show will be passed.
Yeah, right.
So really, the point is that there's a great lineup of comics every week.
Every week, 8:30 at the Lash in downtown Los Angeles.
If you're in Los Angeles or you're going to be next week, go see it.
It's so
free comedy.
Right there.
It's downtown where there's so much fun stuff to do. In fact, Friday night, have you seen this movie? The next thing up on our agenda was talk about movies.
Let's talk about movies.
Did you see... have you seen the documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself?
I never heard about it.
I mean, this has been playing since 2003 in
right.
town exclusively as educational screenings, especially through the Cinematheque,
right.
because it's a three-hour documentary about how Los Angeles has been used as a location and the really disastrous effect on the psyche of the city that... has come about because of how the town is depicted and lied about. And, you know, it's the most photographed city in the history of humanity.
Right.
It's also the least photogenic city in the history of humanity. And so often the photographs lie.
Right.
The cinematography lies. It's, of course, used as other locations. But when it's used here, we don't tell the truth about it, which we would get in trouble for lying
city.
About it if we went to any other city.
I know.
So
right?
it's fascinating in that regard. It's a really, you won't always agree with it, but for 3 hours, I mean, it is a really interesting view.
Fantastic.
And it's just the narrator, it's just a first-person kind of stream of consciousness narration, although the text supposedly was written by the director. So I think it's a combination between the narrator and the director. But it really lulls you in, and I will watch bits and pieces of it, like when I need to unwind late
right.
at night or in the middle of the night, because it's really fun to see these images all through clips from movies. But because of that, for the longest time, it couldn't get distribution because the licensing was so complicated and the fees so astronomical. I don't know how they finally were able to do it.
Right.
But I'm sure probably friends of the production and friends of the filmmaker worked really hard behind the scenes. So some 11 years after it premiered, it's finally available for streaming on Netflix.
Ah, fantastic.
But there was a free screening of it at a public room in Union Station
on Friday night.
And preferential seating to anyone with a tap card. Which is what the film argues.
Exactly.
That the savior to the city is walking and taking public transportation.
Transit.
That if you don't, you don't have a clue what the city's about.
That's true.
You don't know the best of it. You don't know the most beautiful of it.
And you don't know the humanity of it, the multiculturalism of it.
So that was kind of a live event.
Oh, that's kind of fun.
But also a film that I've seen, and I encourage you to check it out, but also anyone in Los Angeles and anyone really who loves film history. It's just such a fun movie, and it will turn you on to movies that you want to seek out.
Oh, is that right? Oh, good.
Yeah.
Is it still playing at you? Union sedation?
No. That was just a one-time thing.
And now I have to find it. On
March 6th, I'm going to be attending a live event. Or, I'm sorry, March 13th there in the old ticketing area.
Oh, yes, where they filmed Blade
Runner.
There's
a live performance piece going on there about the history of downtown.
Ooh.
And it's basically a performance piece with slides and with historic information about how downtown Los Angeles is the greatest theme park in the world.
It's true. And, it almost, I could see that.
You know, with Bob Baker Marionette Theater is better than Fantasyland. You know, I mean, this kind of thing. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to doing that. Going to eat at Tracks beforehand. And
well, maybe I might join you on that. It might happen.
So that could be a lot of fun. Anyway, saw some movies also that, I saw Kingsman for a second time.
Oh,
We chatted, and I liked it more the second time. Liked it the first time, and we sang its praises, but right. You started criticizing it on Topless Robot.
Did I?
Yeah.
What did I say that was criticism?
It was came out was the criticism of them being able to breathe through tubes stuffed into toilets.
Well, yeah. I'm just saying, if the water pressure, I thought about it afterwards because I'm having toilet problems, and I'm going, well, if you fill up the room with water, there'll be so much pressure that it will flush down the toilets. So if you're in your room and you make it an aquarium, the aquarium has to be sealed off, so you wouldn't be able to stuff a tube down a toilet and continue to breathe, because the nature of the toilet is that all the water would flush out. It's like four drains.
But he does say that as long as you pushed it down and up enough to get it around the curve and up. That's what he actually said.
Yeah, but that's a vapor lock only when the water's in the bowl at air pressure, at like constant pressure. As soon as you flush it, then the water goes through it. So technically, because there were no lids on the toilets, they were all rising up. The water was filling up the room that they were in.
But the water was not coming up through the toilet.
No, I know. It doesn't have to. The water would have gone over the bowl ridge and would have flushed down.
This explanation was, again, in honor of Leonard Nimoy.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you, Spock.
Thank you, Spock, for water pressure and air pressure and how the toilet
I'm
works.
Sick of your half-breed interference, do you hear? there are obviously criticisms to be had about moments that are missed, especially comedic moments that are to be missed.
Right.
Matthew Vaughn sets up some great moments and never can pay them off, especially when it comes to moments of potential performance.
Ah.
But the second time, and I didn't criticize the movie for that. This is who he is, you know? And that is, to a degree, to criticize the movie for what it's not rather than for what it is.
Right.
The point that I want to make is the second time I see it, what the movie wasn't doesn't bother me at all. And what it was, I took even so much more joy and delight in, including the really subversive nature of the film, as we've talked about.
Right, the Illuminati reducing the population.
But also putting the audience in the position of the villain.
Yes.
Was very interesting.
Yep.
In multiple ways, both because of politics, but also because of relationships to violence. I regaled our friend John Giroto with ways in which the movie was subversive after the fact, and there were many more. But
awesome.
I just wanted to say that. I mean, I
saw
really,
it again.
And enjoyed it more.
Still doing great at the box office, thing.
A comedy that I finally caught up to, I've been meaning to see for years now.
For years?
Scream of the Bikini is the name of this film. And it was it turns out, I think it was the last project to feature our friend Philip Newby in it. And I had forgotten that
he was in this.
But it's from director Kiff Scholl. And I know Kiff's work as a stage director and writer for Theater of Note and Sacred Fools.
Right.
He made this film, Scream of the Bikini, that came out, I think, in 2009. And it was released as a long-lost masterpiece by a fictional, I think, Argentinian filmmaker. So it's a spy film from the late 60s.
I get it. Black and white?
No, color.
Color?
In stunning color.
Oh, really? Oh, fantastic.
It's in English, dubbed into English, by the American actors who are pretending to be the Argentinian actors. So indeed, the credits are all the Argentinian
actors.
Credits.
Yeah, right.
And this is not for everyone. This is not. But man, this movie had me laughing.
Really?
God, there are just some lines that are so funny. And I really think it's such a loving kind of tribute to seeing these movies,
right,
which we did see when we were kids on TV after right. school. And it's, if again, if you love movies, you'll love it. If you love the 60s, you'll love it. You know, if you love Screamed. Comedy, you'll love it.
If I love the title, I'll love it. I
love it. And there is a performance by one of the lead actresses, Rebecca Larson, whose work I first saw in La Bette, a stage play at Sacred Fools that Philip Newby was one of the cast members of,
right.
That reminded me so significantly, again, as if I needed it, but of how important ensemble and supporting players are. Because here was a play that literally worked because you cared about the supporting players played by Philip Newby and Rebecca Larson.
Uh-huh.
Because the lead is, I won't say reprehensible, but really, really tough to like.
Ah, fantastic.
You know, one of these things where you wonder why anyone would like him. I mean, a genius, but you wonder why anyone would like him, let right. alone love him. But you believe the characters played by Philip Newby and Rebecca Larson so completely, and you care about them so completely, that because they care about what happens to the lead character, you care.
Ah.
Which was...
That's pretty remarkable.
Really remarkable. That's and incredible. I saw that play several times. It was performed not in the round, but I guess three quarter. And I went several times so that I could see it from multiple perspectives. And
cool.
It really was a different show
wow.
each time, especially because of the large ensemble. But anyway, so that's where I first kind of fell in love with Rebecca Larson's work. She auditioned for me for a project once a few years later. But her performance in Scream of the Bikini makes me just want to say that Rebecca Larson should be in every movie, period. She's that funny and,
oh
and
my gosh.
Cool. And
now where can one see Scream of the Bikini?
I think I saw it Amazon Prime.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It was just sitting there waiting for a viewing.
Viewing, yeah.
Wow.
So that's a little hidden gem that people can...
And should.
Well, maybe. Enjoy.
Okay.
You know, we, in our topless robot appearance,
yes.
Luke Thompson asked us, the subject came up about championing films.
Oh, yes.
So that they do get remembered
survived.
Beyond their initial, like I'm doing here with two
Scream
other
the
movies.
Beginning.
A 2003 documentary and a 2009 Scream of the Bikini. See how it all plays together.
Yes.
And a movie came up that you hadn't heard of called Blue Ruin.
Yes.
And Luke wished that he had remembered it at the time of doing his top 10 list so that he could have championed it. I wish I'd seen it at the time of doing my top 10 list. It may very well have made it. The first 30 minutes would rank as one of the top four films of the year last year. It was a first-time effort. It won the Director's Fortnight at Cannes for first-time filmmakers.
Wow.
It's a tale of revenge. I'm going to spoil just the opening scene so that hopefully people will be turned on enough to watch this. Now, it is a bloody film. It is violent. It is about revenge,
right.
as I've said. But it subverts your expectations at almost every turn.
Fantastic.
It's not quite as great as the work of Jeff Nichols, who did Take Shelter and Mud, and whose first film was Shotgun Stories, but it bears a lot of similarities to Shotgun Stories. It is about how an act of violence can ripple through entire generations of a family.
Right.
And so the opening scene starts out on a house, a fairly nice, maybe it's Craftsman, I don't quite remember, but a fairly nice house and a fairly nice suburban-seeming neighborhood, I would guess somewhere East Coast, Middle East Coast, like Delaware, and it turns out I think it was Delaware. And you go inside the house, you can tell it's a practical location.
Right.
But it's so clean and so tidy that already I'm saying to myself, ah, man, I don't know if this feels to me like they used this location because they could get it.
Right.
It's a cheap film. What can we get for free? So this is why they used it. Production design just said, okay, well, yeah, we'll just use it as is.
Let's go.
Because we don't have a budget. And of course, the owners had cleaned everything up so that it would look immaculate, would look home and gardens.
Yeah.
Right. And so then, but I said, okay, well, we'll wait and see who lives there. Maybe it's a commentary. Maybe they're very anal. Maybe they're, you know, and then you hear that someone's taking a bath and you see an arm reach forward and turn off the water, and then the man in the bath leans forward and you see this kind of grungy, you know, crack dealer in Washington Square kind of beard on this guy, and you go, oh man, this movie already sucks. We're a minute in and there is no way this guy lives, less than a minute in, and there's no way this guy lives in this house.
Right.
I mean, they just are not connecting at all the authenticity of their character. And maybe he is fastidious. Maybe he is, you know, Felix Unger, and they just let the actor decide that looking like a hipster would be cool for this indie film. Indie film equals hipster.
Right.
So I've got all this judgment coming out, right?
Already a minute in.
So he hears something, though. He hears a little noise, and he turns, like, puzzled. And then we cut to a woman getting home with her children. And you go, well, it doesn't seem like this woman and certainly these children could have come from this guy. Smash cut to outside the house where the laundry is drying, and the homeless man who had broken into the house to take a bath flees through the open window of the bathroom and runs away before the woman and her children can find that somebody broke into their house to take a bath.
Ah, fantastic.
So it took all the questions I was asking and paid him off and answered them all. And at that point, I was like, okay, take me wherever. And that's just the first. For the next 10, 15, 20 minutes, as everything's been set up, oh, man, it goes exactly where it should and does so even better than you would hope
It would. And this is Blue Ruins.
Blue Ruin. Okay. Blue Ruin, Ruin, A Tale of Revenge. Again, it is a bloody tale of revenge. It is not a happy film. but boy, it is a keeper.
Wow. I'm liking that.
Oh, another film I don't know if I talked about that I would have championed and would love to champion. And so if I have talked about it, I'm going to do so again. The movie Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson,
about
an Irish priest who is a very good man, who is conducting confession, and one of his parishioners comes in and confesses that he was ritualistically raped and, you know, sodomized by a priest when he was all through his formative years. And, you know, and the priest says, well, have you notified, have you done this, you know, done this? And they have the conversation. And finally the parishioner says, no, the reason that I'm in here, though, is not because of that. It's to confess that I'm going to kill you in 1 week for what this other priest did.
Wow.
And, you know, they talk about it a little bit more, like, why would you kill me, you know? And the guy says, look, you know, the only way anyone's going to really pay attention to this, the only way things are going to change, is if good priests start getting killed for what the bad priests did. That's the opening scene. So he has a week to kind of put his parish in order if he believes that this is going to happen, or flee, or maybe stop the person, because you know he knows who it is, and it becomes a little bit of a who's gonna do it mystery.
Not who done
while
it.
Also getting to know the parish and also getting to know the priest, and the character played by Brendan Gleeson is just a wonderful creation that we haven't seen on film before. The writer-director is John Michael McDonough, you know, the brother of the famous playwright Martin McDonough, and it's, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit of a wrong turn, and some of the tone is you know, isn't always consistent. But boy, when it works, there's no movie like it, and I really did love this movie.
Wow, that's Calvary.
And the ending is so powerful. And, of course, Calvary, not Calvary. There's no help coming over the horizon. It's Calvary, Mount Calvary. It's you know, you meet the Redeemer, where the redemption takes place.
Ah-ha-ha.
The march to Calvary.
Wow.
So, another film that I champion.
Look at you
there
go.
You go.
That's you're finding your indies out there.
I saw the latest Kevin Costner movie.
What?
McFarland, USA.
He's the coach of the Little League?
No, not Little League. This is the true story about the McFarland, USA cross-country team.
Oh, right.
It's made by Disney, and I don't want to talk about the film so much. I want to talk about the fact that I've seen 6 Kevin Costner movies now in 20 months. 6 brand new releases in 20 months.
Wow, that's a lot.
And as the drill goes, I will get to my point Which is, he has long been compared to the likes of Glenn Ford or Gary Cooper.
An everyman.
And I want to make a different comparison to certainly who Kevin Costner is, not who he started when he was playing the, you know, the likes of Elliot Ness.
Right.
There, especially, the Glenn Ford really made sense. And even in No Way Out, although in No Way Out he co-starred with this actor, I believe that Kevin Costner today is what Gene Hackman was for many, many years.
Oh,
this blue-collar kind of everyman, this basically kind of you-expect-to-be-decent person, a certain type of masculinity that's real and believable in a variety of different settings.
Right.
And you look at the variety of these films over 6 months, both leads and supporting roles. Superman's father in Man of Steel.
That's right.
A role played in the Chris Reeve Superman by Glenn Ford.
Glenn Ford.
You have Three Days to Kill. You know, and of course, Gene Hackman did his late career action suspense movies as well. Heist for David Mamet.
That's right.
You have, you know, as well as some other action films, Narrow Margin. And you have a Draft Day, which is really, although it's a supposedly a sports movie, it's a workplace comedy.
Yes.
And now you have, you know, this, which is Hoosiers, another true life Hoosiers movie, by the way, last time I checked, starred Gene Hackman.
Isn't that fascinating? Now, but Gene Hackman, I could see him as the tough coach, but he didn't have the athleticism that Kevin Costner seems to bring. Like, I believe him throwing a baseball. I believe him golfing. I believe him in Tin Cup.
But you're forgetting. I mean, you are forgetting Gene Hackman when he was... Because here's the thing. Gene Hackman was... I think we can safely say middle-aged when he became a star.
Okay.
Right?
Yes, yeah.
Wasn't he? Certainly in his 30s and certainly looked the part. At that time, especially, that was middle-aged.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Night Moves, which was a great detective movie.
That's right.
He believably was a former professional football player, defensive back turned private investigator in that movie. You kind of forget about the physicality of it.
And that's
he was a big guy.
Yeah, yeah.
His physicality as Popeye Doyle in French Connection.
A lot of running and punching in that one. Yeah, that's true. But I'm
tough son of a bitch. And as you pointed out, you know, still taking people down well into his later years.
Yeah, even at traffic and fender benders. Didn't he get into a fight just on Santa Monica one time?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just punched a guy in the head.
Yeah, young guys. Young guys.
They're just like, wow, that's Gene Hackman.
All right, we did our Oscar show last week.
And I won.
There's a couple of Oscar redos that on the agenda that we need to talk about. First of all, I want to address the backlash against Whiplash, because people have asked me about this.
Right.
And, you know, there's been this idea that if you love jazz, you can avoid the movie, as if avoiding great movies is something that is going to make you feel better. And it all kind of cements around this ridiculous downbeat review by a movie reviewer who knows nothing about movies.
Right.
He reveals himself in the review to not know the first thing about film, the least of which is have a story comes through character.
Right.
So your first question is the character believable?
Right.
And then, as a filmmaker, usually your job is to depict the world that you're creating as the main character or characters perceive that world.
Right.
So, are there parts of Whiplash that are not, quote-unquote, realistic? Absolutely.
Right.
But is the main character, who is constantly on the verge, if not beyond, a nervous breakdown and mental illness,
right,
is he not a believable character? I found him to be nothing but believable. His personal relationships, very authentic. His physicality, authentic.
Right.
And did I believe that he was perceiving the world? The question is not is what we're seeing real?
Right.
The question is this really what he believes he's seeing?
Right.
Is this and his experiencing?
Perception? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the movie does that. And unless you address that, you're not addressing a movie. You're basically, and of course, as we know, and in this review in Townbeat, which is ridiculous, it spends most of its time criticizing other works of art and other movies. It spends very little time talking about Whiplash. So again, the bigger someone's reaction, the older the material they're dealing with.
Right.
This reviewer is dealing with some really old material about feeling, you know, like an outsider to popular conversation. And so, as people often do, you know, defends that little niche thing that they love and
right.
that no one else is ever going to be able to love. They love it, you know,
well, and
in the meantime does a real disservice.
Right. I mean, you're always looking for verisimilitude is the word that I always think is sometimes misconstrued, because you're trying to present a reality, but
it's not, as we said, the reality as we would objectively see it in the world.
Right.
It's the reality of these characters' experience.
And so a musician who's been in band practice and maybe had a hard teacher, I would totally see them going, well, that wasn't my experience, or that's not how it goes. And so they would critique the movie on that aspect. And it's their perception as well.
And it's been interesting what a complete divide there's been between people who have wanted my feedback on whether Boyhood or Birdman should have won, and whether Linklater or Iñárritu should have won
uh-huh.
Best Director. As you know, I believed that Boyhood would win Best Picture, but I knew Iñárritu would win Best Director.
Right.
This was a director who had completely preconceived an incredible vision
right.
and put everything towards manifesting a main character's mental illness externally.
Right.
Also, a legion of beloved, or at one time beloved, supporting actors are all giving the best work of their careers.
Absolutely.
That is a testament to the director. Many people have found the film tiring, found it riveting for the first half, but then tiring, as it should be when you're yes. tied with the point of view of someone who is descending
collapsing.
Or has already descended into mental illness.
Yeah.
Imagine how exhausting that is, not only to be that person, but to be around that
yeah.
person. So I, of course, found it riveting and uplifting because it was such a complete and holistic artistic expression of this that I was just over the moon that someone could pull this off and was allowed to pull it off.
Right.
Right. So I never was tired. Those simple facts carried me through. The approach that Linklater takes is in every bit the achievement, the directorial achievement, but it's of an entirely different stripe, which is instead of imposing a particular viewpoint on expressing this material,
right.
it's to set up a framework and to witness what wants to come forward
right.
and serve
it.
That.
Yes.
And serve that. It's totally a different
technique,
way of approach.
Yeah, absolutely.
To it. What I am tired of, and there's room for people to love either or both of those films, what I am tired of is people saying, well, isn't Boyhood really just a gimmick? Isn't it just a gimmick?
Uh-huh.
No, I don't see the gimmick at all. What gimmick? What gimmick? You know what a gimmick is? A gimmick is casting different actors to play a character at different times of their lives because they're famous and they bear a slight resemblance. That's a goddamn gimmick.
Are we talking the Bob Dylan
you
documentary?
Know what? No, I'm saying any movie that shows them as kids and then shows them as adults. We know we have to shoot a film in a period of time,
right.
so we use the gimmick of multiple actor casting. In real life, you don't get to have other people play you because it's convenient and it can save time.
Right.
All of filmmaking is replete with gimmicks to create an illusion of reality.
Uh-huh.
What Linklater did was to go and capture reality.
Removing a gimmick.
Let the actors grow
uh-huh.
into their characters.
Look at that.
It couldn't less be a gimmick. You know, it's... Nobody criticized the Harry Potter movies
for them growing
for you know, keeping the same actors and letting them grow through the years at the school. Why isn't that a gimmick? And that had wizardry
yeah.
in it, which is kind of a gimmick.
That's kind of a gimmick. That's CGI
so,
gimmick.
Yeah, so that's that's the one thing. It's the opposite. Whatever the opposite of a gimmick is,
right.
That's Boyhood.
A non-gimmick.
But my final word on this whole conversation, and my final word on the snubs is just once again, the Academy never has been that prone to picking, quote unquote, the best movie,
right,
for Best Picture.
No, we often go back and reward it later. Raging Bull, 1980 is a perfect example.
I mean, this year was amazing because the three top films, according to critics, were all nominated for Best Picture.
Right.
And five of the top six were nominated. That is almost unheard of. Last year, the top three were nominated, and number one, 12 Years a Slave, actually won. According to critics, the number one was the same as Best Picture, according to the Academy. But the year before that, only one of the top four were nominated, and the winner for Best Picture, Argo, wasn't even in the top six, according to critics. So there's always, it's
always
that's not what it's about. It's what this group of people, which is 80% actors that form this body, what worked for them. And that's not going to be what works for critics, what works for audiences.
Right.
It is that. But also, talking about championing.
Yes.
And what we said on Topless Robot, and what a listener in Topless Robot, and the question that they pointed out, when they asked us about these awards and the award season, was that the Academy has never been particularly adept at predicting what would stand the test of time.
That is true.
Either.
It is very true.
I looked at, I just decided I wanted to see how accurate they might be. So I just randomly took the decade of the 50s.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
1950, All About Eve beats Sunset Boulevard.
What?
And The Third Man, Kind Hearts and Coronet, and Adam's Rib are all not nominated.
Holy smokes. Third Man's not nominated?
51, An American in Paris wins. The African Queen, not nominated.
Holy, okay.
52, The Greatest Show on Earth, which is, in fairness, always voted as one of the worst movies ever to win Best Picture.
Right.
But it beats High Noon and The Quiet Man. Singing in the Rain, not even nominated.
Wow.
53, From Here to Eternity, beat Stalag 17, Big Heat and The Bandwagon, not nominated. Hitchcock, of course, boy, we could do a whole show about how Hitchcock's films were never nominated in the 50s after all the nominations he got in the 40s. But Rear Window, Vertigo.
And which Vertigo is now considered the best movie, beating out Citizen Kane.
Best, yeah, ever. 58,
right.
Gigi defeats The Defiant Ones and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh my God.
But Vertigo and Touch of Evil can't even get nominated.
Wow.
My favorite, though, I think has to be 1959 when Ben-Hur beat Anatomy of a Murder, but Rio Bravo, North by Northwest, and Some Like It Hot all fail to be nominated for Best Picture, which the Academy immediately recognized as such an oversight that I'm convinced that's why they gave The Apartment Best Picture the following year. Yeah.
Because they were so ashamed.
And those are just a few years from the 50s. All of them have this kind of thing. And it's,
right,
you know, so it's never been accurate in terms of predicting what was going to stand the test of time.
Right.
And it's what is best according to this group. And so you can't really say they're wrong because it's how those films worked for that those people and their point of view.
Right.
I'm actually, I guess Birdman won because it was about actors.
Yes.
I mean, I guess that's really why.
It deeply resonated with the group of...
But honestly, with, again, how challenging that film was on some levels to watch because
yes,
it was a workout.
Yeah.
I'm surprised... From, you know, I attend a lot of industry screenings, and
that seemed more challenging than the
they
regular.
They seemed fare. Exhausted. They seemed exhausted. I really was surprised, but I think in the age of the internet and this critical consensus, we might see as the years go on more and more lockstep in terms of at least nominations between critics groups and the award groups, because it really does help shape the conversation that these are the films worth talking about.
Right.
Though, boy, I wish they had included Blue Ruin.
Ah.
And, you know, next year, the Directors Guild, for the first time, is going to start annually giving out a Best Director Prize for Best First Features.
Ah, fantastic.
And that
will be a game changer.
It will be, because those films have a better chance then to be
seen,
discovered, rediscovered and again to stand the test of time. It also helps nurture careers,
absolutely,
which is another way that these films survive. So that brings us to the end of another exciting installment of Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. As always, brought to you by our friends at Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. And hosted by our friends at Blog Talk Radio.
We love Blog Talk Radio.
There are many ways to hear the show. So if one of them isn't working, like Chill Pack Hollywood Hour wasn't this week, you don't, I appreciate hearing about it.
Right.
You don't have to get too bent out of shape because there are many ways you could be hearing it right then while you're letting me know that your preferred way of listening is not available. You can find the show on iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher.
Right.
And almost always, you can find it at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com. Next week, we'll get to emails from listeners.
Yay!
Which can be sent to us how?
At chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
People can also like us on Facebook.
Yes, and they can follow us
on facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
And follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil.
So till next week, I'm Phil Larness.
I'm Dean Haglund.
This death takes place in the shadow of new life, the sunrise of a new world, a world that our beloved comrade gave his life to protect and nourish. He did not feel this sacrifice a vain or empty one. And we will not debate his profound wisdom with these proceedings.
Space, the final frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the starship Enterprise. Her ongoing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life forms and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Belated spoiler alert.